Many psychologists, social workers, even medical professionals are increasingly concerned about the frantic pace of life the average person has in the Western world. That's only been aggravated to a worse degree coming out of the COVID pandemic and additional stresses in terms of the nation being polarized. But just simply look at some of the pace of life here in America. Of course, we are very familiar with how businesses cater to this faster lifestyle, if you will. Almost everything is drive-through now. We don't have to go get our own groceries. We can pull up and they can drop them in the back of our car. We have so many ready-made meals, all kinds of electronic gear to help us produce more work and faster. And we get sort of accustomed to that. I don't know that we consider sort of how much that is a part of our life. I was stunned this past week reading some statistics how much the American worker outproduces the rest of the world in terms of volume, in terms of hours, and so many of these things. But back to my point, even before I became a pastor full-time, my former job is, even though it's 20 years out of date, is sort of an example, because even then I was, I don't know, as I would reminisce or look back at some of these things, because when I started in my career in commercial art, as it was called, everything was done by hand, right? We had what was called blue line boards. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, but in the photographic world, as you would make film to produce anything that was printed, blue doesn't reproduce. So you'd have all your guidelines printed in basically cyan. So you'd have a grid to work off of, but you'd have to literally, type was set, it was run through a waxer, which would make it sticky on the back. You'd have to cut it, you'd have to put it in, you'd have to size your photos, you'd have to put a ruby lift, you know, just all these different things. Some of you know what I'm talking about, some of you don't, but it was all done by hand is my point. But even before I left the last job I had in that field, all of that had been digitized to the point where I was a graphic artist, I was an illustrator, I was a photo director, I was a designer, layout artist, and a webmaster. So I was doing the job of about six people, one person. That's how everything had been consolidated. It didn't shorten the work. I generated almost 600 catalog pages a year, actually only in about 5 months, and maintained a website. I did press checks. I'd regularly have to fly to where the catalogs were being printed to ensure that it was printed properly. And that technology has only become more sophisticated and able to do even more things. But even in my current employment as a pastor, I pastor three congregations. I'm a regional pastor assisting a dozen other pastors. I'm a Council of Elders member as well as a publication reviewer, occasionally write, and even other things that come up. And that's just common, isn't it? We just kind of accept that's the way it is. And it would be challenging, though, for me to do just any one of those responsibilities without the technology that I have. When I lose the internet, I'm dead, right? I can't do much of anything. I can still make some phone calls, but it limits greatly what I can do. And there's no denying then that life is simply moving faster and faster all the time. That pace of life and work, though, can come with a price. Things, physical things especially, that are pushed beyond their design limits fail at a quicker rate. You know, we burn up cars. My car is a tool. It's 2 years old. I have 70,000 miles on it already. So they wear out, don't they, when you push them? And it's a great irony that in an age of such time-saving devices that we're stressed as a culture more than ever because of the demands of society around us. And I'll give you just one example I find shocking in some ways, but really sad in other ways. On average, more than half of all U.S. workers give up 50% of their vacation days a year. So whatever vacation time they have, more than half of it goes unused. So let's say you have 2 weeks. A week is all you're taking a vacation a year. That's, if you add it up, it's more than 662 million days that are given up because they need to work instead of taking time off. And it can be about a number of different things. They could be worried about their job security. It could be not worth the stress of catching up later. You know, my wife and I were able to go down and help our daughter and son-in-law with a number of projects before their baby comes. And I came home, and I don't know how many emails I had because I just basically walked away from it while I was down there. And I finally got caught up on Thursday. you know, but none of it gets done when you're not there. For some people, their identity, though, is tied to their employment, right? What their job is, this is a problem for a lot of men. When they retire, they don't know what to do because that was their identity. But we clearly live in a world that doesn't value a slower pace of life. Some of you, though, are very young to not maybe know this, but I still remember when the newspaper USA Today was started. That was a groundbreaking publication. What was groundbreaking about it, there were two things. One, it was the first national newspaper that was printed in color. Secondly, it was the first paper that made it known they were deliberately writing for a younger education. At the time, it was eighth grade. They said eighth grade education. So very simple articles, very simple approach. That now, since then, not just that newspaper, I don't even know if it still exists, probably not, but that approach of writing simply to an audience has now moved down to a sixth grade level. But music is written short and catchy, right? If it's longer than 3 or 4 minutes, it probably doesn't get radio play. Books and magazines, as I mentioned, written for a much lower grade level. You know, we're distracted by movies and entertainment, but it all has to be short and quick, doesn't it? You know, and I'm guilty of this as well. You know, I'll binge on 2-minute videos, watch an hour of that, but I won't sit and watch an hour video. I could go on with other examples, but what does any of this have to do with us sitting here today on God's Sabbath? Well, I think the answer is quite simple while being quite foreign to the world around us. And the answer is worth remembering and nurturing. We must be still long enough for God to teach us. So the title of my sermon today is simply, Be Still. We're going to look at being still spiritually speaking so that we're undistracted and able to hear God in the small things. And I'd like to begin in Daniel chapter 12, because Daniel makes a statement here that is very interesting. And it's very much a description, if you will, of where we are, not just as a nation, but as a world that is just consumed with moving about. In Daniel 12 and verse 4, Daniel records this as God speaks to him. He says, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words." Because Daniel had saw these great visions, right? He was in a unique time period in history. He had seen the Babylonian Empire fall. He was, of course, taken captive during that. The Babylonian Empire fell. The Persians were now in power. He'd been given the understanding that the captivity was to last 70 years. Of course, these prophecies that God revealed to him, and I can only imagine the questions going through Daniel's head and the frustration when God said, "No, it's okay. It's not for you. Write it, record it, shut it up." Because he says, "Set a seal on it till the time of the end, that these things would not be revealed until thousands of years later." And he says that many run to and fro, knowledge shall increase. And we can even look at that. For the most part, the world stagnated with knowledge until the invention of Gutenberg's movable type press. But with that came the capability to print on a level that had never been possible before. It was all done by hand prior. Can you imagine writing this by hand? And how expensive that would be. Knowledge not only became easily accessed, but it became affordable. And so then knowledge exploded, didn't it, to where we are today. And look what happened with the internet. And there are upsides and downsides to these things, but it has increased the pace, hasn't it? Even in life in general. You know, to look at somebody that lived even 100 years ago, how much has changed in the world, right? So 100 years ago, it was not uncommon for the average person to not have indoor plumbing or electricity or even a car. We have access to all of that. Look at where we can go with airline transportation, right? In the course of a day, I could pretty much be anywhere in the world, literally, right? Catch the right flights, you're willing to spend the time sitting in an airplane, but still, it would have taken months prior to this to get somewhere in the world, especially far flung. But space travel has come along to the point where I found this statistic interesting as well. 80% of all satellites put in space currently are put in space by SpaceX. 80%. The next closest entity, if you will, is the Chinese government. They put 12% up. 80%. And with that, then look at the access we have to internet, cell phone coverage, all these sort of things. In fact, cell phones themselves, right? Most of us now can't live without our cell phone, right? You leave the house, you check for a couple of things, keys, wallet, cell phone. Yep, good to go. You can't leave your house without it anymore because we do so much with it. But has all this progress made people more or less happy? Has it added to the value of life or taken it away? And I believe this is one of the huge blessings of God's Sabbath day. It was before all those things, I think especially so now. We're given time to slow down, to spend time with our family, and to simply have a break from the world. To pause and reflect and spend time with God that we probably don't have during the week, because how much interrupted time do we have to spend with God at any point in the week? Here's another sad statistic. Studies done on the amount of time parents spend with their children are truly sad. For mothers in the U.S., they devote about 2 hours a day with their children. 2 hours. For fathers, it's only about 85 minutes. So how do you connect with a family? How do you know who they are? How do you teach them who to be? And yet this is the norm, isn't it? Parents don't have much influence with that amount of time, really, compared to the rest of the day. So who has the influence? U.S. children and teens spend anywhere from 1 to 2 hours a day watching TV. Now, that has waned, that has dropped, but it's only because of social media. They spend about 4 to 6 hours a day on social media. So about 8 hours of their day is connected to something else. Because, as I said, our culture lives for the next distraction, the next thrill, the next thing that will entertain us. But we keep coming back, those of God's people, if we're looking at the world and looking at what God is teaching us to be and become, what mankind doesn't understand is that most of the social problems we have are because we don't listen to God, right? We fail to follow his instruction, we think we know better, and we reject his morals. But those morals point us to the way to live, don't they? I'd like to begin in Scripture in Hebrews chapter 5, because the writer here says something very profound to consider. One of the expressions, if you will, that I use on a regular basis now is that we have, as I mentioned, this unprecedented access to knowledge, right? I don't even have to go online anymore. I can simply ask Alexa. Right? And I do this on a regular basis. Like, oh yeah, I can just ask. So I'll just ask a question, and it's a rare occasion where there's not an answer. Right? All this information out there. But it's a mile wide and an inch deep, isn't it? There's not much there beyond that. And the writer even addresses this to God's people in Hebrews chapter 5 here in verse 11. I want to read this to you in the International Standard Version because it's, to me, a lot more pointed. It says, we have much to say about this. He's talking about a number of different things here. He says, we have much to say about this, but it is difficult to explain because you have become too lazy to understand. Wow, you talk about the 2x4 across the face. But are we? Are we too lazy to understand? I can't be bothered, or I don't have enough time, or whatever it happens to be. Because even God's people are not immune to the pace of life around us. And if we're not careful, we're distracted with the rest of the culture, right? We find ourselves at the end of the day, and we don't have time. Let's go next to Job chapter 2. Because I think here in Job we find sort of an example, if you will, of what we read in Daniel 12, this pace of life. And I wonder if the pace of life is not only promoted by Satan, but it is a reflection of him. In Job chapter 2, we find, of course, this interesting behind-the-curtain view, if you will, of a conversation between Satan and God. And I could probably go on about a lot of things. I suspect Satan is irritated every time he has to report to God, because he still knows he's under his authority. and he's not happy. And then God sort of sets the stage for Job to have some challenges here. But in Job 2 and verse 2, we find this. God says to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Now, God knows, right? He's all-knowing. He's interested in the answer. But what is Satan going to say back? Where have you been going? And Satan, in my mind, is like a petulant teenager, right? He says, I've just been going here and there. Right? It's just not really an answer, is it? It doesn't describe what he's doing, what he's thinking, what he's encountering. He says, I've just been going back and forth of the earth, walking here and there. I think that's a reflection of Satan. I think that's what he promotes because it is who he is. But, you know, even 50 years ago, people as a whole were less formally educated. My grandfather only went to the eighth grade. Now, this is early 1900s, and that was very common back then because you had to go work the farms, you had to help the family, and so forth. But have you ever done a search on what that eighth grade education looked like? Most college students couldn't pass those exams today. So they were less formally educated, but one thing they did know in a lot of cases were the scriptures. Because everybody went to church, didn't they? For the most part. The culture as a whole went to church. And even if they didn't have a lot of books, they almost always had a Bible in the home. And so they were at least knowledgeable on a superficial level, if nothing else. But today, formal educations are much more prevalent, aren't they? In fact, for a lot of jobs, a lot of white-collar jobs, even if the degree is not important, they're looking for the college education. They're still looking for that as a sort of a minimum line, if you will. But people are extremely biblical illiterate, right? Most people don't own a Bible anymore. And so consequently, they're ignorant of God and his ways. You'll see this every so often. They don't do it, but I still remember at times when shows like Jeopardy, if they had any Bible category, it was almost humorous. All of the contestants would stay away from that category until the very end. They didn't want to touch that because that was one area they knew that they were very weak in. And it's only gotten worse since then. But back to this running to and fro, I think of Satan in this regard. This frantic pace of life that just keeps us so busy, we're not necessarily accomplishing things, we're just busy. But let's go to the end of the book of Job. As God leads Job through this trial, it was not about Job being this awful person. There are many people that say it was because of Job's self-righteousness. No, it was not. That came as a consequence. That bubbled to the surface. Because at the beginning of the book, God even says to Satan, this is an upright man, right? Which would have been a lie. And Satan would have called God out in a heartbeat on that if it was not true. But Job had something to learn, didn't he? He had a lot to learn. So in Job 36, we then get to the conversation where Job's friends, who were not really friends, they had unloaded with him enough, he was done with that. And the young friend, the youngest one that came in after the fact, if you will, was actually the one that had the better part of wisdom. And he was reminding Job of a lot of different things here. And so when he's done, then God has the conversation. So let's just jump into verse 26 here. Job 36 and verse 26, as God had recounted some of these different things for Job to consider. If you're so upright, if you're so righteous, if you're so wonderful, what about all these things, God says. So in verse 26, behold, God is great. We do not know him. This is the young man finishing up his thoughts, Elihu. And he says, nor can the number of his years be discovered. He draws up drops of water, which distill as rain from the mist, and the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man. Indeed, can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds? That one has always made me wonder. You ever carry, if you want to consider how heavy water is, and I forget the poundage, it's like 8 or 10 pounds, a gallon of water. Hold a gallon of water at arm's length. See how long you can hold it out there, right? It gets heavy really quick. And yet we've got all that up in the sky in these clouds. How does that work? We know it's a gas, but it's still got mass, doesn't it? And it coalesces and it rains, and this is what Elihu is talking about. Or the thunder. You know, it's been said that one thunderclap has more power than the world uses in a whole year. You know, just where does that energy come from? yet it's there, isn't it? These charges in the atmosphere that God creates for these things to happen. It says, for these, he judges his people. He gives food in abundance. That's the other thing we've forgotten as a nation. I remember pictures when I was a young boy, you know, the farmers at the end of the year, they didn't have enough silos to put all the grain in. They would pour it down the center of small town streets until they could offload it into trains and take it to wherever it was going. There was just so much. He covers his hands with lightning, commands it to strike, thunder declares, and the cattle as well, concerning the rising storm. And so he's reminding Job of these things. And then we move to chapter 13, and he continues on, I'm sorry, chapter 37, but let's move to verse 13. He reminds Job of these things, and he says, he causes it to come, whether for correction or for his land or for mercy. I mean, there's a lot to consider here. I'm hitting just the high points again. But, you know, how do the trees know to go dormant? And they do it in different stages, don't they? In my yard, it's the willows that always lose their leaves the last. And it's amazing how long they hold on to them. But yet they're one of the last in the spring to bring the leaves back. When do the flowers know to bloom? You know, that ground, my ground especially, because our yard can be wet, very wet in some sections, it is literally like concrete in the middle of winter. Right? It is frozen solid. And yet you can plant garlic, you can plant different things, and it's ready to go in the spring. I don't know how that works. God does all these things. When was the last time we stopped to consider any of that? You know, this time of year is hunting season. How do the deer know it's hunting season? They know they're not just out and about, right? They go hide, and they can hide really well. But, you know, just how all of that works. When was the last time we sat quietly before God? And I don't just mean church service. I mean whenever. We sit down to study our Bible or to give prayer to God and to just have the purpose of allowing him to fill our mind with the right thoughts to help us have that right perspective. I'm going to go through a series of verses here, and I don't normally do this, but I want to impress a point. So let's go back to Exodus 14. Again, I'm going to move through some verses, but I want to highlight an expression. And these are not all of the verses that use this expression, but I want to begin to build on this thought. So in Exodus 14 and verse 13, of course, the children of Israel here leaving their captivity, and I can only imagine the euphoria they had after 400 years of being under the thumb of Pharaoh and seeing all that God had done on Passover to deliver them. And so in Exodus 14 and verse 13, Moses says to the people, do not be afraid, right? Because they're up against the water now. They have fled out, and it seems this is unsurmountable. Mountains on both sides, deep water in front of them, and Pharaoh behind them. They have no place to go. And I can understand their uncertainty, but they were looking at it physically, weren't they? So Satan reminds them, or Satan, Moses reminds them here. He says, stand still. That's a key phrase, right? Just wait. Stand still and see the salvation of the eternal, which he will accomplish for you today. I don't think we pay attention to that enough as a church. We want to fix things, don't we? We want to get past whatever we think the hurdle is here, the wall in front of us. We want to move. I think that's this culture that we're so familiar with. It's just standing at times and saying, okay, God, I'm going to wait for you to show me if I need to do anything. Because oftentimes we make things worse by trying to fix things. So that expression, let's go to 1 Samuel 3 next. First Samuel 3 and in verse 1, we have here Samuel's first prophecy, as my subhead says. Samuel kind of coming into his own, if you will, as a prophet. And he was young. It says he's a boy in verse 1. The boy Samuel ministered to the eternal before Eli. Eli was the high priest at the time. His sons were not very good men. Right, they were profaning what they should have been doing as leaders before the congregation. They were taking things for themselves. and had become a problem, Samuel ultimately takes on this role, but nonetheless, he's just a boy. And yet he's engaged on this level. It says, the word of the Eternal was rare in those days. There was no prophetic utterance. There was no widespread revelation. It came to pass at that time while Eli was lying down in his place. This at night, right? They're going to bed. He's lied down in his place when his eyes had begun to grow so dim that he could not see. Before the lamp of the Eternal went out in the tabernacle, this was one of the duties of the priests, right? To make sure that the lamps were trimmed, oil was in them, they were to never go out. It says, where the ark of God was, Samuel was lying down as well. And the Eternal calls to Samuel and he answers. I think this is a great expression. Here I am. He doesn't even know what God is going to ask. Samuel, I'm here. What do you need? So he runs to Eli, thinking it's Eli who's calling him, right? He's a boy. He says to Eli, here I am, for you called me. And Eli says, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't call you. Go lay down again. So then verse 6, God calls again to Samuel. Samuel. So he arises, he goes back to Eli and says, here I am. He says, I didn't ask for you. Go lay down again. It says in verse 7, this inset thought, Samuel didn't know it was God. So verse 8, the Eternal calls Samuel again a third time. He goes back to Eli. Eli says, because he's perceiving here, go lie down. It's God who's calling you. If he does this again, then simply say, your servant hears. Let him say what he needs to say so you know what he wants. So Samuel does. And in verse 10, the Eternal came and stood and called, as at the other time, Samuel. Samuel answered, speak, for your servant hears. Now keep that in mind as well in regards to this standing still as we kind of build on this thought. Let's go to Psalm 46 next. Would Samuel have heard God if he was not predisposed to hear him? That may seem like an odd thing, right? But if I'm distracted, if I'm really focused on a task even, I can miss all kinds of things. I've done this before, right? I leave the house thinking I'm going one place, and then I realize I'm driving to somewhere else. Because I'm just in this habit, right? You get in the car and you're going to a certain place, whether it's Sabbath service or it's to go do a visit or a Bible study or whatever it is, and it's like, I'm not going the right direction. You finally wake up. Everything's on autopilot. So, Psalm 46. This is a song of Korah. There are a number of those which are interesting to read through. But nonetheless, these are descendants of Korah who rebelled. So not all the family followed their patriarch, their father. So this is, God is our refuge, very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. We sing this, right, in one of our hymns. Even though the earth is be removed, and though the mountains are carried away in the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and tremble, though the mountains shake with its swelling, there is a river whose stream shall make glad the city of God, the holy place, the tabernacle of the Most High. What is this saying? It doesn't matter if the world is crumbling down around your ears, right? God is still there. He's still in his holy place. God is in the midst of her, verse 5. She shall not be moved. God shall help her. Just at the break of dawn, the nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melted. The Eternal of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Come, behold the works of the Eternal who has made desolations in the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in fire. Be still. We come back to that expression. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations and exalted in the earth. Be still. We think of that as being very, very passive, but it's not, is it? It's actively listening, waiting. I'm engaged and I'm waiting for instruction. Let's go back in Psalms to chapter 4 and let's look at how some of this looks. Because what does it mean to be still? Like I said, we can think that just means doing nothing, but there are aspects of being still. Psalm 4 and verse 4 says, be angry and do not sin. That's a challenge. right? Because in my estimation, anger is probably the most powerful emotion God has given us. It can so easily get out of hand, right? Because there's so much emotion involved, and because anger kind of takes on its own life if we're not careful. Meditate within your heart. What do you do when you meditate? Everything else is set aside, isn't it? Ideally, you're in a quiet spot. There are no distractions. You're focused on simply pondering. So one way to be still and not be angry is to meditate, right? Take a pause. I still remember this saying. I don't know where it comes from, if it's one of these timeless proverbs or what, but it's better to be thought a fool than to speak up and prove it. Sometimes we just need to just let it be for a while and see where things are going so we know what we need to do or not do. Let's look at Nehemiah chapter 8 and consider another aspect of being still. Nehemiah 8, of course, is very famous, if you will, because this is where Ezra reads the law to the people during the Feast of Tabernacles. They had lost, if you will, the books of the law, what Moses had recorded, for hundreds of years. And there's this revival, if you will, that's happening within the nation. And they were so, on one hand, energized to once again have this information. But on the other hand, they were very sad to realize how much they had failed in keeping this close. So Nehemiah 8 and verse 11, we read this. It says, "The Levites then quieted all the people." What was the job of the Levites? There were many different jobs, but probably the most or highest responsibility was for them to teach the people the law, right? Teach them God's instruction. And so they're still there engaged. And notice what they say. Be still. These people are very sad on one hand, as I said, but very excited on the other. They're very conflicted here, aren't they? But they say to the people, Levites here, be still, for the day is holy. Do not be grieved. So we can be still in worshiping before God. It's okay, essentially, is what they're saying. We can't go back and unring the bell, can we? We can't go back and change things. So just from here, let God speak to you. Let's go to 2 Chronicles. Another example of, in times of crisis, how to be still. 2 Chronicles 20, and in verse 17. This is a time here where the Ammonites and some of their allies came to battle against Jehoshaphat. This is the northern kingdom. And things were not looking good, as oftentimes is the case during times of war and conflict. But just to highlight verse 17 here. Jehoshaphat is being spoken to here by Jahaziel, if you go back up to verse 14. And he's giving instruction and an encouragement to Jehoshaphat here. So in verse 17, he says, "You will not need to fight in this battle." You know, how many times do we fight in a battle we don't need to fight in? So he says to him here, "You don't need to do this. Position yourselves." Notice, stand still. And see the salvation of God. Just let God take care of this. You can still show up. I want you to pay attention so you see what God does. But you don't have to do anything. I mean, think about how many times God did this with Gideon and his 300 men. First of all, that whole winnowing down is very interesting how that happened. But it's 300 men. How are they going to fight? They've got a trumpet and they've got a torch with a pitcher. Right? And he says, you don't have to do anything. Just blow the trumpet, break the pitcher, let the lights shine, and just watch what happens. And God took care of it, didn't he? There's so many times that God did that. Going back to Exodus, the Israelites didn't have to do anything. Just wait. Just wait. God will take care of it. I can only imagine what it looked like with that water separated. Fish and whatever else flopping out. The wind coming through and drying up the ground. Because you've got to know that mud underneath there is just saturated, right? And then God takes care of it. He says, God is with you. O Judah and Jerusalem, do not fear or be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, for the Eternal is with you. But notice, go out against them, but at the beginning of the verse, don't fight. You can show up. We have to show up, but let God take care of it. Lastly, in this regard, let's go to Isaiah 23. Isaiah 23 and in verse 2. This is a proclamation, specifically this chapter, against Tyre, who was a power at the time in the Mediterranean area. But just consider it for anyone who is in opposition to God. So Isaiah 23 and verse 2, he says, "Be still, you inhabitants of the coastland, you merchants of Sidon, whom those who cross the sea have filled. Be still, even in opposition to God." So how do you be still in this regard? Stop sinning. Right? Sometimes we need to be still so that we can see I'm not doing the right thing. Because when you're engaged, right, it's very easy to just keep moving forward. You know, I've got good news and bad news. What's the good news? Making really good time. What's the bad news? We're lost. Not really helpful, is it? So stop sinning. Okay, I want to use one example here at a longer discourse in 1 Kings 19. We have here the example of Elijah. And it's always interesting to read these accounts and to see how human the people are involved in these accounts. Elijah is considered one of the greatest prophets of Israel. And you read the various accounts of what he did. Even Elijah, his protege, if you will, did even more amazing things with God through him. But nonetheless, this was a time of great distress in the country. Ahab was king. Jezebel was doing great harm on the nation, promoting all kinds of false things. Just awful in so many ways. And so in chapter 19, 1 Kings here, we have Elijah running for his life after all that God had done. Now, just previous to this was the victory at Mount Carmel. All right? Elijah representing God, these 300 priests of Baal, and they spend the whole day trying to summon Baal. And Elijah makes fun of them, doesn't he? Well, maybe he's in the bathroom. Maybe he's sleeping. Maybe, you know, shout louder, cut yourself more. Maybe you just haven't gotten his attention. They go through all of this and nothing happens. The offerings are on the altars. They've soaked it so much water's pouring off during a time of drought and famine. And Elijah does this short, heartfelt prayer. And not only is the sacrifice consumed, everything, right? The stones are burned up, everything. He rallies the nation. They kill all the prophets of Baal. And Jezebel is furious. And what does Elijah do? Runs for his life. After seeing and being a part of all that, he runs for his life. So in verse 1, Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah. This is, as an aside, this is something to be careful what you ask for. Right? Because Jezebel says, "So let the gods do to me, and more so, if I don't make your life," speaking to Elijah, "if I don't make your life as one of those that you killed by tomorrow." Basically meaning, kill me if I don't accomplish this. Well, she got her wish. She didn't know how it would come. But anyway, that's further down the story. And so what does Elijah do? When he saw it, he rose. He ran for his life. He went to Beersheba. How far is Beersheba from Mount Carmel? It's about 90 miles. First of all, he was in really good shape. Right? That's ultramarathon kind of distance. He ran for his life 90 miles. He didn't want any hint of being close to her. He wanted to be as far away as he could. So he runs to Beersheba, which belonged to Judah. He's in Israel again, left with his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, came and sat down under a broom tree. And when he had prayed, notice what he prayed for, that he might die, he says to God, "It is enough. Take my life." Well, that's the easy way out, isn't it? God says, "No, I'm not going to do that." So he's laying there. Angel comes. And what's the best thing to do when you're in the middle of a trial? Have something to eat, take a nap. Right? Gain some perspective. This is what Elijah does. He falls asleep. God, in his mercy, sends an angel with food and says, "Okay, Elijah, wake up. Have something to eat. You'll feel better." Right? You won't be so hangry. So then he looks and he sees this. He eats. He goes back to sleep. The angel came again another time. Says the same thing. Notice, your journey is too far from you. You know, have some more food. You're not done yet. So he arose, he ate and drank. He went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights. He's moving every day. So he's going from Beersheba to Horeb. How far is Beersheba from Horeb? It's about another 100 miles. But this time he's not running away, is he? He's going where God wants him to go. And so then he ends up at this mountain. Notice verse 9, this cave. He spent a night in that place, and God speaks to him. He came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And I can only imagine him saying, "You told me to come here. I'm here because you said so." That's not what God was asking. Why are you doing these things? Why aren't you out doing what I want you to do? So God says, or Elijah says to God, "I've been very zealous for the eternal God of hosts, for the children of Israel. You know my record. You've seen what I've done." He says, "And I've torn down their altars. I've killed their prophets. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." That's a pretty defeatist attitude, isn't it? But really understandable for all that he knew, he was the only one. So then God teaches him. Verse 11, God says to Elijah, "Go out and stand in the mountain before the Eternal." Right? He's in this cave. So go out of the cave, just stand there. And God passed by in a great wind, so strong it tore the mountain and broke the rocks in pieces. I would not want to be in the middle of that. Right? Just literally see this mountain tearing itself apart. What are you going to do? Where are you going to go? There's seemingly no protection. But it says, notice, the Eternal was not in the wind. Elijah's probably wondering, where's God? Right? We can ask ourselves that at times. Where is God? Does he not see me in the midst of whatever we're going through? Does he not see how I've followed his instruction? Does he not see the persecution I'm enduring here? This is what Elijah's going through. But God's using all of this as an object lesson. So then after this, the rocks being destroyed and all this earthquake happening, verse 12, God sends a fire. But it says the Eternal was not in the fire. Now, there have been occasions where I've used accelerant to make a fire. Those are fires you want to be very careful with, right? Because they whoosh. And that heat that comes off of that is something else. I still remember when I was a boy, the easement driveway that my parents used for their place also had two other houses on that driveway. And the neighbor at the far back, I don't know what the circumstances was, but his house caught on fire. And of course, it was a big fire. This whole house is burning. It was so hot it melted the glass. I still remember watching it melt the glass. That's how hot it was. But you could not get close to it because it was that hot. Elijah sees something very similar, probably even more so here. But it says God's not there. So after the earthquake, after the fire, notice then God sends a still small voice. Verse 13. "So it was that when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle," his cloak, right? He covered his face. "And he went out and he stood in the entrance of the cave. And suddenly the voice came to him and said, 'What are you doing here?'" Didn't say that in the earthquake. Didn't say that in the fire. Said it in the still small voice. God is not always in the rushing mighty wind. He's not always in the earthquakes. He's not always in the fires or the thunderings. More often than not, it's my assessment, if you will, that he's in the quiet things. Right? Because in the midst of chaos, it's easy to not hear or to be distracted. The small things, the small voice is where we'll hear. And more often than not, if you study public speaking, it's not the ones who yell or have a high volume. Even as a boy, I couldn't take a lot of that when men were speaking and they were almost yelling through their whole sermon. It's the soft voice that more often than not gets the attention because you have to pay attention, right? You're not yelling it. There are some that have said it's very interesting in the English language. The word listen has the same six letters as the word silent. And there's much to ponder there. But there's also another interesting story I would like to relate along this matter of being still. Some years ago, way back before refrigerators, people would keep things preserved over the summer if they needed to be cold in what were called ice houses. These ice houses were truly amazing. They had very thick walls. Usually they were lined with metal on the inside. They had no windows in order to keep that ice as long as they could, because the ice they would pull out from time to time and put in, we call them refrigerators now, but in a smaller ice box to keep things cold that needed to stay cold so they wouldn't spoil so quickly. So consequently, in the wintertime, this was a big project. The rivers, the streams, the lakes, whatever, the ponds would freeze over. Men would go out and they would cut these blocks of ice out of these bodies of water, and they would haul them to the ice house, and they would stack them, covering with layers of sawdust so it didn't become one big ice cube, right? You needed to have them not stick together. And so then this ice would last, sometimes through the whole summer. And the story was told that in Wilmington, North Carolina, there was an ice house there located across from Cape Fear River. In the course of harvesting, if you will, some of this ice, one of the workers lost a pocket watch, which may not seem like a big deal to us. You know, I can go to Walmart and pay $8 for a watch. Back then, it was quite an expensive thing, very expensive. But he lost it, so you can imagine he wanted to find this. He searched and searched for the watch in the ice house. He couldn't find it. He went through all the sawdust that he could. His workers also tried to help him, those that worked with him. They were trying to find this watch as well, but they didn't succeed either. And so there was a small boy hanging around, hearing this conversation, all the men taking a break to go to lunch. He slipped into the ice house. And before they were done eating their lunch, he came out, he had the pocket watch. And they were all pretty amazed, and they basically said to him, "How in the world did you find this?" He says, "Well," he says, "when I closed the door, I laid down the sawdust and I kept very still. So no windows, right? No light, no sound, thick walls. It's very quiet in there." He said, "I just laid down, kept very quiet. Soon I heard the watch ticking." So oftentimes the question is not whether God is speaking, but whether we're still enough and quiet enough to hear. Because sometimes God can be in the earthquakes or the great fires or whatever it happens to be. But again, more often than not, he's in the still small voice. And I find that reinforced by the example of Jesus Christ. How many times did he go into the wilderness or find a quiet place to pray with his Father? No distractions, because that was the important thing. Luke 5, John 11, many other places. So let's conclude in Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5 and verse 16, Paul here writes, he says, "Redeem the time, because the days are evil." When my family came into the Church of God, it was the late 1960s. Of course, John F. Kennedy, the president, was assassinated earlier in that decade. 68, I think it was, his brother was killed, assassinated. Martin Luther King was assassinated around that time. Vietnam War was heating up. The civil riots were still going on from 1965. There was great turmoil in this country. I never thought I would graduate high school before Christ would return. Fast forward to the end of 1970s, you have the oil embargo and how that just changed everything in the world. The cost of oil skyrocketed, changed economies overnight. Then we had the crisis of the captives in Iran in the early 80s, early 80s, like 1980, somewhere in there. And so you can say, well, it always seems like there's no time left. But days have just gotten eviler, haven't they? They've gotten more evil, not less evil. So this is even more important. So how do we redeem time? Redeeming doesn't always have to mean that we're doing something. It can also mean that we make it more valuable or more worthwhile, right? We're redeeming it for a purpose. So how do we do that? Well, in two general ways. We make quiet time in our personal life, which means, as I mentioned, the hours that we can spend with social media, the time that we can spend with TV, and I'm as much as the next guy. There are times I just need to just disengage, right? I need quiet time to kind of refocus, but I don't need 6 hours a day to do it. We can limit the distractive activities, the things that are not necessary. right? Because we want to do so much, sometimes we don't say no to things that are not critical, that take away from these other things, or even to spend more quality time with family. One of the great pieces of advice Roxanne and I received when the twins were very young is invest in memories, not in things, right? So take the trips, go to the museums, do these things. So that's one way. But how do we then make it quiet time to hear God? Well, of course, the four important things: daily prayer, Bible study, meditation, and regular fasting, right? To humble ourselves, to slow down, because even if we're working our normal job, if you will, during a day that we're fasting, you're going to be reminded, aren't you, that you're fasting. It's going to make the thoughts different. It's going to put the focus in a different place. So do we value a slower pace of life spiritually? Do we know the value, see the reason for doing that? Are we nurturing our relationship with God by being still long enough for Him to teach us? Let's be still so we can hear that small voice.